Welcome everyone to the Stimulants and Methamphetamines Educational Webinar, brought to you through a Community Benefits Investment Grant partnership between SAFE and Bon Secours Health System. I'd now like to do some housekeeping tips and to introduce our keynote speaker. Again, I'm Bunny Chittister, the Prevention Specialist with SAFE. Please put your name, agency, and location in the chat as you join us and we come together today. All participants will be muted for the entire session. Only the speaker and hosts will have microphone access. We ask host and the speaker to mute their microphones if they aren't speaking. All questions must be typed in the chat box located at the bottom of your screen. We'll do our best to get to all questions at the conclusion of the presentation. All participants will receive a copy of the PowerPoint and a link to the recording after today's webinar. Please see the link in the PowerPoint to the stimulants and methamphetamines data and resources available to you from the national, state, and local levels. Complete the evaluation at the end of the webinar by following the link in the PowerPoint or using the QR code provided. SAFE will hold a random drawing of entrants completing the evaluation for one winner of a $50 Amazon gift card. We value your feedback. It helps us ensure successful future webinars. Our keynote speaker has so much useful information, we've allotted her 50 minutes to present and 10 minutes for question and answers afterward. This will put us slightly past 1. If you must log off at 1, that's fine, but please stay for the Q&A session if you can. And now it's my honor to introduce Dr. Ronit Lev.
Great.
Slide, please. Ronit Lev, MD, FACEP, is dually board certified in emergency and addiction medicine, bringing over 25 years of experience treating the frontline cases of addiction. Dr. Lev was the first chief medical officer of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy from 2018 to 2020. She came to the White House as chief of the emergency department at Scripps Mercy Hospital in San Diego, where she continues to practice medicine and consult on clinical medicine and health policy. We're honored to welcome Dr. Ronit Lev.
Well, hello, everybody. It's definitely an honor to join you today. And thank you so much for the invitation. And thank you for the prevention work that you do and is so important also on the front lines in protecting our future, protecting our youth. And this is, do we even remember this? This was a year ago when my first, I didn't even know what a PAPR was. And I had to put one on ready for my first patient, thinking that, you know, this could be the end, but going to put a smile on my face anyway. And to let you know that we knew way back then that, you know, the pandemic may come and go, but the issues of drugs were always there. And our emergency departments were full of patients with drug use issues and complications and mental health issues. Even as we were waiting for an onslaught of COVID patients, these other patients continued to come. So I like to start with a quiz to get people thinking. September 2017, one person died and 7 were hospitalized after exposure to methamphetamine from... Can you guess what it was? Was it marijuana-laced meth, 7-Up, burritos, or beer? True story. It was 7-Up, and there were 70,000 bottles. That's a lot of bottles of meth-laced or contaminated Pepsi-Cola from a Pepsi-Cola plant in San Diego. That was a big recall event. It happened across the border, but where San Diego is a border town, and definitely affected us and was a public health issue. So we're going to talk about cases from the front line. I feel like I work in the front lines in the emergency department, we're talking about stimulants, methamphetamines, and in the emergency department and in the medical examiner's office. So we'll talk about meth in the body, the emergency department, the medical examiner's office, and we'll end with some M&Ms. So thank you to Breaking Bad and Walter White for making methamphetamine famous, at least on TV, although it is really rampant. And I work in ground zero of methamphetamine, really We're doing a study now of emergency department drug surveillance throughout the United States in different places. And we definitely win the prize as the most amount of methamphetamine. I think 75% of our urine drug screens in the emergency departments are positive for methamphetamine. It's really tragic. But methamphetamine is a central nervous system stimulant, a neurotoxin, a psychostimulant, and a recreational drug. And it's not blue like in Breaking Bad, it's white. There are some famous people who have had an addiction, a substance use disorder to methamphetamine. Andre Agassi, Marilyn Monroe, and very interestingly, Adolf Hitler at the end of his life was getting all sorts of drugs and addicted to many different substances, including methamphetamine. And by the end of his life, he was hiding out and had the slurred speech and movement disorders, classic of someone who has a methamphetamine use disorder. And a lot of other famous people that you could really shows. These were pictures that done as a campaign years ago on methamphetamine, showing the physical changes that people experience besides the mental changes people experience when they have chronic use of methamphetamines. So a little history. Amphetamine started, discovered by Germans in 1887. 6 years later, the Japanese added a methyl group to that amphetamine and discovered methamphetamine. And World War II, meth was used as tank chocolate, and there's a picture of that, for the pilots to keep them up and going and moving 24/7. And interestingly, now, if you ask people who use methamphetamine, especially the homeless, that's exactly why they use it. They say they need to stay up and protect their things and be alert. But unfortunately, that doesn't last. It became a diet pill in the 50s and 60s and became abused and then became a scheduled drug. And today, if I need to, I can write a prescription. I can write a prescription for methamphetamine. I could write a prescription for amphetamine as meth is prescribed as desoxin, not very commonly used, but if we need it medicinally, we're able to do that in an FDA controlled and milligram and scheduled fashion. So a little chemistry lesson. The reason it's called meth, it's because it has a methyl group on top of the amphetamine molecule. In the middle, you see the amphetamine molecule, and that circle, that CH3 is a carbon with three hydrogens. That's called a methyl group, and that's methamphetamine. So if I do a drug screen on a patient and they're positive for meth, they'll probably be positive for amphetamine if they had it in their system for a while, because methamphetamine metabolizes, it breaks off that methyl group into amphetamine. But it doesn't go vice versa. If someone tells me they're taking Adderall, their tox screen should be positive for amphetamine. They can't just all of a sudden add a methyl group that didn't come from their prescription. And then Sudafed, you could see how Sudafed is very related to amphetamine. And when people are like cooking meth in their backyard, they are blowing off that oxygen and hydrogen in that square, red square from Sudafed and making amphetamine. And nowadays, that's very old fashioned to do. I mean, it's possible, and I guess it still happens, but most of the meth coming into our country and coming through the Mexican border to San Diego and going around the country is made in mass production, more purity and done in a, business, a large scale fashion from in Mexico. So there's a difference between medicinal methamphetamine that we can prescribe versus illicit. And the difference is 10 to 100 fold, including impurities. So it is much, much more potent. It's not the same thing as well as the various contaminants in comparing medicine versus what people buy on the streets and their baggies. So what happens when you take methamphetamine? At first, there's a rush. People feel a surge of dopamine and feel good and stays for 5 minutes. And that's the pull and the attraction to using the drug. That levels off in a shoulder. And then tweaking, I won't share with you my tweaking imitation that I do just for my family, but we see that daily in the emergency department. We now know what that looks like and see that people are tweaking from methamphetamines. And what's very interesting is people who are using don't realize that they are acting differently in front of other people. They don't see that in themselves. And then the crash, we see this in the emergency department as well. That's the patient. I come and say, hi, I'm Dr. Lev. How can I help you today? And they're not interested in talking to me because they're sleeping and they're tired. And they also don't put together that they're crashing from their meth. And that can last for a few days. And it takes about a week to get normal. And really that the length of time it stays in your system and remains a problem in your system is why it's such a problem in the emergency department. And I'll be sharing with some examples with you why that happens. Methamphetamine goes everywhere. And I explain this to my patients. I actually worked last night. I had a patient with an abscess that required drainage. And, you know, well, I don't know how that happened. And I haven't used for a while. But when you snort the methamphetamine or however you ingest it, inhale it, inject it, and those little crystals keep going around your blood. They don't just come out, and they may circulate in your blood for months and then pop out in your skin or affect your brain or your circulatory system or attack your heart and your teeth. And that continues. So it takes a while. It's not just you used one time and it's out of your blood. It's still there and it's still causing problems. And we see pictures of methamphetamine literally causing holes in the brain. And this is a picture of a spectrogram of blood flow. So showing blood flow in the brain of a normal smooth brain and one with holes in it. And for someone who's using methamphetamine on a regular basis, the good news is if you stop using methamphetamine, you can get your brain back. And I use that terminology with my patients who are in recovery. I ask, did you get your brain back? And it takes a while, but you can get your brain back. So a little bit understanding of addiction. Addiction is a chronic relapsing disease of the brain. Chronic meaning it's a lifetime problem. If you have an addiction and pull, like if you have hypertension or asthma or diabetes, that's a chronic disease. It's relapsing. It means that it can happen again. And it happens in the brain because it affects your dopamine. So the cycle for addiction is true for any type of drug, whether we're talking about nicotine, alcohol, marijuana, methamphetamine. Drug use increases dopamine. You feel that surge. And then you need, the body says, okay, well, I got enough dopamine. I don't need so many receptors. And now there's a new set point in your body that needs more and more dopamine just to stay alive, just to survive. And it's a vicious circle where the new normal that you need to wake up in the morning is much higher for somebody who has an addiction versus who doesn't. And the circles on the right kind of show that. So in a baseline, I get up in the morning, brush my teeth, and come and do this wonderful webinar with you. The amount of dopamine I need is about 15 to 40 units. Best day ever, I won the lottery, my son's getting married, 100 units. And you could see how people who use marijuana, heroin, methamphetamine, their amount of dopamine goes up and their new normal of what they need just to survive is much higher, and how methamphetamine by far is the highest in smart of that resetting that dopamine surge, and just really a strong pull in addiction. And getting back to normal, getting back to baseline is possible, but not easy. It takes time. So now we'll talk to some cases in the front line in the ED, in the emergency department. This is a classic symptom that we're very, you know, probably take care of at least one or a few of these a day. Excited delirium. This I call a visual diagnosis. I see not two cops like in this picture, like at least six police officers, paramedic, a patient with a spit bag over their head, in restraints, still agitated. Really, it's a violent reaction. It's violent to the patient, hurting themselves, violent to the staff. And the first thing we need to do is get control for the patient and for the staff. And so what do we do when someone is very violent and on drugs is give them more drugs. And we have what we call the B52 cocktail, or some people use other medications can be used with Benadryl, Ativan, Haldol, ketamine, various types of drugs that we use in order to get control of the situation as fast as possible. And then we ask ourselves, what is the mystery drug? What could it be? In San Diego, that drug is methamphetamine, but we call this, when we get the drug screen back, lighting up like a Christmas tree, where everything on the drug screen is positive. And that's very common. Methamphetamine, marijuana, PCP, other things, fentanyl. So we first have to get control of the situation. And knowing what drug it is helpful because we know meth will last a lot longer, than alcohol, people who come in with alcohol. You know, being ground zero for meth has really affected us as far as behavioral health and mental health conditions. That is huge. And because methamphetamine causes psychosis, causes these violent reactions, and causes what we've now termed, not a medical word, but one that we use, being methicidal. We also have drunkicidal, and I realize that that is stigmatizing language that we shouldn't use, but I am sharing with you as professionals that, you know, that's behind the scenes language that we have. And that means that once somebody is off, the reason that it's helpful, we know, for example, if we use for alcohol, if someone is coming in and they're suicidal while their alcohol level is 400, once they sober up, you know, they get their brain back and they think clearly and they can, you know, respond to resources and not necessarily need admission. And, you know, for somebody who is drunk with alcohol, we have more experience with that lasts, you know, for a few hours. Methicidal patients, that could take 3 days, and they're in our emergency department for 3 days, not hours. And that's why it takes such a toll on the emergency department in taking precious bed space and resources with patients who are awaiting sobriety from their methamphetamine for them to get their mental health back. Other psychiatric conditions, I just like saying the word formication because it sounds like a bad word, but it just means that people feel that they have bugs on them. And that comes probably from itching that caused from methamphetamine that I showed you, those crystals go in the bloodstream all around, and people actually believe that they have, you know, various types of bugs on them that, you know, they see, and they'll say, look, can't you see it? And it's like, I don't see it. It's part of the psychosis of methamphetamine, in addition to very types of hallucinations, depression. And, you know, when you're on methamphetamines, you're probably not using your other medicines that you should be taking as well. This is just a picture to show you what a toll mental health and drugs have on the emergency department. So this is at 6 o'clock in the morning in our emergency department, the quietest time of the emergency department typically, where we had 22 patients, but 16 of them were being held for a mental health problem. A lot of that, we estimate half of that or even more, is related to drug use. And if you could see, there's one patient who was there for 189 hours. That's 8 days. This is not just my emergency department. I'm just not calling out my emergency department. This is happening across the entire United States as a specialty of emergency medicine. This is one of our greatest challenges. We call it boarding in the emergency department, or psychiatric boarding in the emergency department. And there is a strong affiliation of that with drugs, and explained why with methamphetamine, it's even longer or a bigger problem than other drugs. Here's a patient who came in by paramedics, 911. He passed out. A young person in his 30s who passes out, maybe had a seizure. You know, they can't really explain. Nobody knows exactly what happened. Comes in the emergency department for us to figure things out. And then he does this. And this is what's called a torsade de pointes. It's a type of ventricular fibrillation or sudden death. Why would a 32-year-old have this happened to them? This is a life-threatening problem. We got him back and saved him. But the reason it happened is because methamphetamine. And if I see a young person with a heart problem, chances are, with the amount of methamphetamine we have in California, it is from methamphetamine. Methamphetamine attacks the heart muscle to the point that it can't pump well and can cause these different arrhythmias. So this young gentleman, his heart was pumping maybe 15% of a normal pump, and he needed to have an implantable device to make sure he doesn't go into this again and survive this hospitalization. We knew this was coming long ago. This is an old graph with an article published from their VA Medical Center in San Diego, alerting, I think the title of the article that was published was "A New Epidemic of Methamphetamine." And the alert on the cardiac effects and heart effect of methamphetamines was made years ago. And now they're not even tracking it because it's just commonplace that we see this so often. One study done for my hospital showed a four-fold increase in the people who have methamphetamine that coming into a cardiac clinic for congestive heart failure. The average age of someone with heart failure who's using methamphetamine is much younger than somebody, older in 60s or 70s who have congestive heart failure. And the point is methamphetamine attacks the heart muscle, and methamphetamine, alcohol, cocaine attack the heart muscle, but I see that more often than not in methamphetamine, very, very common. Heroin, opioids, it does not attack the heart muscle. We don't see that with the other drugs. What is heart failure? Well, when your heart, the pump of blood in your body doesn't work well, then the blood backs up, just like any other, water flow piping, plumber would know. If there's a clog and things aren't moving well, then things back up, and they back up into your lung, into your legs, into the other parts of your body. And when it's in your lung, it causes shortness of breath and coughing. It's a huge problem in our country. About 6 million Americans have heart failure. It costs a lot of money, a lot of hospitalization. And again, this is probably old data, but much more often right now, it's a regular problem that we see in the emergency department and in the medical examiner's office. When you see people who die from methamphetamine, that's not an accident. It's probably a cardiac death. Rashes, this is our bread and butter in the emergency department. Very common to have abscesses, even after and rashes, even after people are using again, because that meth, those crystals are circulating around the blood and popping up on the skin. And this is very common. Often it's MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph infection that we treat with antibiotics. And abscesses, I mentioned the guy yesterday, we call a hot pus, cold steel, a chance to cut, a chance to heal. When you have a ball of pus, it's not going to heal just with antibiotics. It needs to be opened, and it could progress to even necrotizing fasciitis. That's like flesh eating, where you actually have to go into the operating room and open things up in order to release and get rid of the dying skin. Meth mouth is common. I could look at people's teeth and say they probably use methamphetamine. And even again, the problem lasts way after they stop using. It's because the acidity of the methamphetamine causes the dryness of the mouth that causes that. Infectious diseases are common, just like with any other drug use of hepatitis, HIV, wound botulism. Every year we get an alert that goes through our health system that's saying, oh, be aware of wound botulism in this batch of heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine. And here's an example of drug driving. I was an expert witness in a patient who caused an accident, and four hours later, they finally got his blood drug screen, and his level was 406 nanograms of methamphetamine. And you could see, I made this chart for the courts showing, low, high, and the highest if he was getting medicine. I said I could prescribe medicines as a methamphetamine versus the red where you're dead. That's life-threatening. And he was hours later that high. And even with this data, we could not convince the jury that he was impaired. They just saw numbers. It was difficult to convince the jury that this was impairment instead of just toxicity and poisoning. So I really don't know why we don't have per se laws for methamphetamine. It would be so easy to find a cutoff. We did it for alcohol. We could do it for meth. And again, drug driving is wreaking havoc on our street. And again, I've asked, the jurors, would you rather have someone with 0.08 alcohol or 406 methamphetamine? We would rather have neither. But weaving and tweaking and all the mobility and thinking problems that methamphetamine causes, it's not somebody that you want to share the road with. What about treatment? How do you treat methamphetamine disorders? It's very, very difficult. It's difficult for a couple of reasons. One is there's a huge denial in people who use methamphetamine of that they have a problem. And I think I know why. If you have an opioid use disorder, when you stop using, you have terrible withdrawal symptoms. You're throwing up, you have a headache, it physically affects you. You feel it. Anybody who has an opioid use disorder, when they stop, the withdrawal symptoms of opioids are horrible. People feel sick. When you're withdrawing from methamphetamine, you crash. You sleep for 3 days. It doesn't hurt you. And I think that that is why it causes such a denial. And people who you have an opioid use disorder are more readily able to admit that it's a problem, and they feel the effects when they stop, while people who use methamphetamine don't feel it as much. The other problem is that there's no FDA approved medication to treat methamphetamines. There's a lot of studies out there, and people in the addiction and psychiatric community say, oh, let's try these various drugs, but there's nothing that's FDA approved and really nothing that's ready for prime time. And I would caution anyone to say, hey, we should use Wellbutrin or mirtazapine or whatever else, because I'd say, remember the opioid epidemic. Remember back then in the 1990s when we said everybody can be treated with opioids and no problem of addiction based on a study of 38 patients, and then we unleashed it on America, and only now are cleaning up the problems from that. You can't take a study on 100 patients or even 400 patients and say this is good for all of America, and then now have two problems, a methamphetamine problem and a prescription drug problem. So here's some examples of one study that was really celebrated this year from the New England Journal of Medicine on 400 adults who had a methamphetamine use disorder. They were studied for 6 weeks. That's not a long time. And at 14% of them were successfully treated at 6 weeks with Wellbutrin, bupropion, and naltrexone. And people were saying, isn't this wonderful news? Yes, it's wonderful news. It gives promise. It's not a standard of care. For 14% success, to me, that's failure, 14%. But I think I talked with people who were, involved in the study, and they thought, well, okay, it's not meant to be a cure on methamphetamine for the entire country. It tells us that we are moving in the right direction and trying to find solutions. Okay, but that's not a solution, 14%. Another trial that was done on 120 people who have MSM, stands for men who have sex with men, in San Francisco, very specific population. This is not all the country. And their results were 15%. And they said, okay, this is a great, 15% is better than zero. But I'm going to show you in the next slide better results than 15% or 14%. I've had a lot of physicians ask me, well, why don't we use amphetamines to treat methamphetamine use disorder? Well, we use, methadone, and we use Suboxone to use opiate use disorder. Why can't we do the same thing? And it's not FDA approved. And then remember the slide where I told you the amount that you would need to prescribe, like 10 to 100 fold would put you in that danger zone of toxicity, and why it is not FDA approved. So the gold standard for treating methamphetamine use disorder is contingency management. Contingency management is a behavioral modification system that has been successful and studied in veterans population. And their success rate is way higher than medications, 50% in a study at 12 weeks, not 6 weeks. And there have been 92% success rate in 28,000 patients at the VA. So currently, the gold standard treatment for methamphetamine use disorder is contingency management. And here's the problem. Why aren't we doing this? Here's the data showing that it's so wonderful to use. And the problem is there are regulations that prevent it. And you cannot, by law, it'd be called getting a kickback. So I can't say, come to my clinic and I'll give you $100 to come see me and use federal dollars from your healthcare to do that. So doing that, the way this is why these studies were done with the VA, because they were able to do that. Now there are workarounds. There's workarounds with smaller dollar amounts as incentives. And there are workarounds in saying that, you know, this community in Virginia is at high risk. We're going to do this as a county project. We're going to follow all these protocols, and you would be able to do that in your community. So there are barriers, but they can be overcome. And if you're interested in implementing contingency management in your community, this slide has various resources on the proper way to do it, and how, and you know, and guidance on how to do that. It's not easy. It's not as easy as, oh, take this pill and it'll be better. There's methodology, and clinics need to watch their, you know, the prizes or dollar amounts or whatever they're giving, like they would watch a their medicines. You know, you have to keep track of that in a controlled way. And there's definitely ways of doing that, definite workarounds, but it is, you know, it is a barrier, but doable. There are various apps out there you can get on any of your apps and any of your iPhones that do contingency management. Dynamicare, Reset, and WeConnect. There's three different apps that are out there. Some of them are paid, and some of them are specific to methamphetamine. Some of them even connect with drug screen. So these are resources if you wanted to use and look at them and implement in a program in your community. What about the medical examiner's office? All right, so national data, and you could see even from back in 2019, I think now it's even gonna be higher. Psychostimulant deaths increased 37%. The big orange graph, that's fentanyl. And we know that that's a huge problem. You could see prescription drugs are going down. I would say that we don't have a prescription opioid epidemic anymore. We took care of that. We could still do safe prescribing. That's another lecture. We definitely have a fentanyl problem, and you could see stimulants are on the rise as well. This is just to show you how methamphetamine and fentanyl are connected. Sudom, you see on the bottom right, is synthetic opioids other than marijuana. That's CDC wonder language. That's fentanyl. That's 98% fentanyl. So you see that 25% of methamphetamine deaths included fentanyl. That's old data. Now the percentage is going to be much higher. And we'll show you your own data that proves that. Your own data is always a step ahead of federal data, and that's why it's so important and so wonderful that the Virginia Department of Health is supplying this data. And you could see that you have up-to-date information as of 2020. The amount of methamphetamine that you're seeing deaths have increased 94.4% in the past year. That's crazy numbers, and I'm sure you're feeling it by seeing these statistics, because death is the tip of the iceberg. For every person who dies, you have a lot of problems with mental health and violence and suicide and accidents and health effects. And the other thing that you have, and this is again, wonderful data that the Virginia Department of Health is providing, is almost 65% of the deaths are associated with fentanyl. What does that tell you? That tells you that if you have somebody who uses drugs, they need naloxone. Naloxone reverses opioids. It doesn't reverse methamphetamine, but every single person in Virginia and around the country who's using methamphetamines should have naloxone because of this strong affiliation and contamination of meth with fentanyl. This is just an example of what we're doing in San Diego. We have a methamphetamine strike force. It's been in existence since 1998. The straw that broke the camel's back, the tipping point was when a person high on meth stole a tank, drove through the freeway. Really amazing footage that's available on YouTube with this tank going down the freeway, you know, breaking lights and other things. And the city government said, enough's enough, and we need to do something about methamphetamine. They created the meth strike force in existence, and today the meth strike force had a measured effect in decreasing methamphetamine for a good period of time. And now we're back. Now we're back and things are terrible again. And we're doing various projects, a treatment hotline, dealing with precursors of methamphetamine, getting people in the recovery, trying to reach out to endangered children, crisis lines, housing, because a huge, you know, San Diego is also the third or fourth largest community of homeless people in America. And many of the people who are homeless are using methamphetamine on the street. So that's an issue in various such art. And whatever we're doing, it's frankly not even enough. This is a report card that's been published for many years. And you could see that the type of things that are being measured, just if you wanted to do this in Virginia, we collect data on deaths, emergency department visits, arrests, lab cleanups, availability, sales, how much things cost, and hotline contacts. So what are the M&Ms? Besides being my favorite candy, it's when I showed you that slide of the drug screen popping up like a Christmas tree. Most people don't use just one drug. They use a combination. And I'll say it's meth and methadone, methamphetamine and marijuana, methamphetamine and mental health and methamphetamine. I had to find something with M, so I wrote missing a home, being homeless. So really various combinations. So now I'll share with you some of those combinations. Cocaine, and the Department of Health shared data, and I'll show you about cocaine rising in Virginia. And a little bit of a difference between cocaine and methamphetamine. Both are psychostimulants. One is plant derived. Cocaine comes from the coca plant. So it comes from a plant. Methamphetamine is synthetic. It's made in a lab. Cocaine lasts just a few minutes. People, you know, get their high and lasts for an hour and then it's down. And methamphetamine, like we talked about, really lasts a long time, 8 or 12 hours for the high, and even more before 12 hours is the half-life, and even more to be down to normal. Where it works in the brain is different. Both raise, like all drugs, raise your dopamine, but how that dopamine goes up is different. In cocaine, the dopamine goes up by blocking the uptake of dopamine. So if instead of dopamine getting metabolized and going away, that is blocked, and so it builds up. And in methamphetamine, what it does is it releases more and more and more dopamine from the neurons, and that's how you raise dopamine. And as far as toxicity on the brain, cocaine is not directly toxic on the brain. And while methamphetamine, it does and has much more neurotoxicity and more psychiatric and long-term psychiatric symptoms from that. So deaths of cocaine are going up. And along with that, like any drug in our country, it's associated with fentanyl. And 50% of fentanyl deaths, more than methamphetamine, are associated. 50% of cocaine deaths are associated with fentanyl more than the ones with methamphetamine. And this is a national graph, again, old data, now even more, but you could see this affiliation. And now you could see with your own data in Virginia, the amount of cocaine deaths increased 33%, not as much as meth, but still going up in the past year. And 82%, again, most of those deaths are associated with fentanyl. I was asked to talk about kratom because kratom is an increasing problem and use, and people don't know what to make of it. Like, what is it? Is it safe? Is it herbal? Is it all right? Is it a treatment? Is it abused? Kratom is a plant. So this is a plant-based, not synthetic, from Asia, an evergreen plant. There are about 5 million users in the United States. The actual chemical that causes stimulant effects in that plant is mitragynine, and that causes the high, the anxiety, the agitation, the aggression. And then the other chemical in the plant is 7-hydroxy mertagynine, and this causes the opioid effect, sedation, nausea, constipation, itching, the things that an opioid would do. Long-term, that we've seen changes in pigment, tremors, appetite problems, psychosis. Now, most people who use kratom use it to treat their opioid addiction, their opiate use disorder, whether they realize it or not. They feel really good and really committed to using it because, yeah, I used to use heroin or prescription drugs, and now I'm using kratom, and isn't that better that I'm using something natural? The problem is that you don't know what you're getting, and it's not FDA regulated. So there have been, and here's the data under problems, a tenfold increase in the number of call to poison centers in a 5-year period with kratom, cases of salmonella outbreaks in 38 states from kratom, agitated delirium, that's that violent reaction related to kratom. You don't know how, I mean, it's not dose related. When you're taking something like that, you don't know what you're taking. And there have been deaths associated, 152 deaths over 18 months in a year period related and tracked to kratom. And that those deaths and contaminations led the FDA to issue an alert saying that there's no evidence that kratom is safe or effective in treating any medical condition. Now, here's a side note. Look at the little symbol there on the right of your screen, USP. And I know kratom is sold as a dietary supplement. So are a lot of things, CBD, vitamin D, zinc, you know, whatever you're using for COVID. But you don't know what you're buying when you're buying supplements. You know, it's a gamble. Unless you see this symbol, if you see a USP symbol on your vitamin E, then you know that it went through a standards process, and you can trust the rigors and the verification that you're really getting what you're buying. Otherwise, you don't know what you're getting, if it's placebo, if it has contaminants, if it has salmonella, you know, if unless it goes through this scrutiny, you really don't know what you're buying. Now, this is a lecture on methamphetamine and stimulants, but we really can't avoid talking about fentanyl. And I showed you why, especially in Virginia, where 80% of methamphetamine deaths are associated with fentanyl, and 60% of cocaine deaths are associated with fentanyl. Fentanyl has been just a game changer. And here is one of the ways it plays out in the emergency department. A patient will come in and they say, I just don't feel well. Okay, well, what's wrong? I don't know, I just don't feel well. I ask about drug use. Do you use meth? Yeah, I used it. When did you use it? 3 hours ago. And 3 hours ago, you should be feeling high, and that's what you're used to. That's why you use the meth, to get that high, and you're not feeling high. You're laying there in fetal position and not moving. And I'll ask the patients, I think that you may have been exposed to fentanyl. Do you want to find out? And they'll say yes. Most people don't want to give me a drug screen, but they want to know. And they were exposed to fentanyl. They have a mix. They have the methamphetamine and they have the fentanyl. And it's not going to be an exact science when you have the two together. I've heard the term you know, California speedball for the combination of fentanyl and methamphetamine. And it means that the symptoms and presentation that people come in with as patients is not classic. You're not going to have the classic fentanyl pinpoint pupils, sedation, not breathing, or necessarily the classic agitation of someone being high and methamphetamine. It'll be a combination, and it can't really be predicted because you don't know how much of what you're getting. And that's important, you know, medically, because I'll have people who are out. And the paramedic said, well, they didn't have pinpoint pupils, so we didn't give naloxone. Well, if they also have methamphetamine and fentanyl, an opioid and a stimulant, you may not have those classic signs. And so the answer is just give them naloxone. It's not going to hurt you. It may help. And we've seen patients, I've treated patients who, you know, they're going on their way to jail for whatever reason. Now they collapse. Everybody's freaking out. And it's from fentanyl. And again, fentanyl is much stronger than heroin and morphine, and is not in the entire drug supply. We have seen fentanyl in methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, pills of Xanax, Percocet, ecstasy, and even vaping marijuana products. So really, if you are getting drugs anywhere outside a pharmacy, you can be exposed to fentanyl. Anybody who's using illicit drugs should have naloxone. And by the way, you should be able to get naloxone from your doctor or the pharmacy without a prescription. But if there's anybody out there who needs a prescription for naloxone, they can go to my website, hightruths.com. I'll show that at the end. And you could download your free prescription. Frankly, it should just be over the counter. And you know, there's thoughts of getting that over the counter. It's not there yet. But until it is, anybody who needs naloxone should get one, no questions asked. A project that we're doing in San Diego is testing for fentanyl that as a gold standard. Right now across America, there's few hospitals who are routinely testing for fentanyl. And that's just wrong. I just showed you all the data, and that graph speaks to itself. The killer in America for drugs is fentanyl. Why aren't we testing for it? There's really no excuse. Fentanyl testing is available today in every hospital in America by buying a reagent. And there's three different reagents out there to work on the chemical analyzers that hospitals have. Clinics, on the other hand, don't have chemical analyzers. Those are the $500,000 machines that test for, you know, chemistries and different blood tests. So clinics may not have access to fentanyl. But today, every hospital in America has no excuse for not including fentanyl. And we are promoting it as to check universal and automatic in every drug screen. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. It does not show up as an opioid drug screen. And you need to add on this test. And it should be, doctors shouldn't be thinking, oh, should I have fentanyl with this? Should I add this on? You should add it on. You shouldn't be having to think about it. And it should be done. If you're interested in the fentanyl toolkit, then I have a link to the website below in that. We also have model legislation. If you wanted to introduce legislation into Virginia, federally, I'd like to get it in California to make it routine. I can help you out with that as well. Why test? You know, physicians will say, well, why does it matter that I have a positive test? I already know that they have fentanyl. They already reversed with naloxone, which takes multiple doses. So why is a test important? And by the way, that picture is a burrito full of, we had a drug bust of burritos that were filled with fentanyl. I shouldn't laugh. That's not funny, but a burrito, it just shows you what a problem that we have. What can a positive fentanyl test do? And it could really save lives. It makes a difference. This is one where a test can make a difference and save lives. It tells the provider that there's a problem. It alerts the patient who may not have known that they were exposed. That patient will now go home and tell their friends, yeah, guess what happened to me? You know what I mean? Remember those pills that we took? And it also gives them an opportunity for naloxone to the patient or to their family and friends. And it connects, if there is a person who has a problem, connects them to treatment for fentanyl, for methamphetamine or cocaine or whatever the problem is, as well as fentanyl. Not everybody who tests positive for fentanyl has an opiate use disorder. They may have other drug use disorders. So it's an opportunity to make a difference. The other M&M that I said was methamphetamine and marijuana. And this is my favorite diagnosis because this is another word I like to say, which is scromiting. And the screaming and vomiting. So I had a patient who was being observed. Like I said, patients with methamphetamine are abused over observed over several hours in the emergency department, sometimes days. And so as we were giving report, one doctor to the next, I was coming on shift. And so we have a person in this bed. He's waiting to detoxify from his methamphetamine and then be evaluated by behavioral health. When you're out, you can't be seen by behavioral health. So again, that's why it takes days in the emergency department until you're awake enough to talk to someone from behavioral health. And then all of a sudden, this guy who's waiting for methamphetamine to speak to behavioral health, he's retching and retching and retching. And that has it. This is, I call an audible diagnosis. I can hear and I know the sound. And that's not the sound of methamphetamines. That's the sound of marijuana. And people who use marijuana on a chronic basis, usually smoking more than edibles for years, and they think that, oh, I need it to help my appetite. I need it for sleep. I need it for whatever. It causes the opposite effect and causes cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. I know it's hard to say cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, but if I tell patients, you know, you're scromiting, they'll look it up and they'll see that that means screaming and vomiting, and they'll relate to that more. And that's why my favorite diagnosis, because when it helps me talk to patients and they're able to understand scromiting, because they'll think about it. It's like, yeah, I guess that's what's happening to me. And they'll listen. When I used to say cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, it was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And that word scromiting was from a press conference that we had about cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. We developed a protocol that avoids opioids, and we wanted to let the public know about that and the medical community be about that. Nobody showed up except for one reporter, and she published the word scromiting, and then that word went viral, and now it's a common language. I wanted to share one resource for you. We're going to have a press conference on this organization May 20th. So you guys get a preview on the International Academy on Science and Impact of Cannabis. Isaac, we are a group of doctors, medical professionals like me, who are educating on marijuana. And if you ever need to look up any sources on marijuana, we have a very helpful medical library with various summaries. And if you're into looking at that, I urge you to look at the library page of this website on isaac1.org. And if you're interested to hearing more from me, I have a weekly podcast talking about various issues, including methamphetamine and marijuana and various drug use and preventions and treatment, High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, available with your various platforms for podcasts. And you rock. What you do is so important, so crucial, not enough of you. You are really protecting our youth, protecting our public, alerting people to things that they don't normally hear about. Don't be discouraged. There's billions of dollars of industry working opposite of you. And that just makes what you do even more important. And I really, really thank you. Your work energizes what I do. I want to help you in any way I can. And I can't thank you enough. So thank you. And I hope that you have lots of questions. All right.
Hi, everyone. My name is Whitney Whalen, and we will now begin our Q&A. Our first question we have is, I've pushed to get my state, Tennessee, to regulate stimulants as opioids as are regulated. Do you know of any states that are model for stimulant regulations?
I don't know if I completely understand that, but great to have people from Tennessee here. And as far as regulating stimulants, methamphetamine is illegal, so I'm not quite sure how to answer that question. Sorry about that.
Alrighty, and we have another one here. Is there a website that can be visited in order to determine what a medication falls under? I work in a probation department, and many of our clients say they take medication, and that is why they have tested positive. Is it difficult for staff to determine the validity of the claim?
There are professional medical review officers who do that for a living. If I definitely see the challenge there. There's one website, drugs.com, that you could look up different medications and see what it's used for. I think that that's a common one. I refer people to that website, drugs.com, to see the various drug interactions with marijuana products, because I put in cannabis or cannabidiol for CBD, and you could see that like there are 400, 500 different drug interactions that pop up. As far as people saying, oh, well, you know, it's because I had some poppy seeds and, you know, that's why I'm positive. That's rarely. I think that you would need to make yourself a little chart that's available in various textbooks. It's like if someone says that they're using whatever other excuse, that's why you have cocaine. You know, that's why I have cocaine in my system. That's not available. But I do see your point. That's something now to think about, that there should be maybe charts for probational officers giving false positives. So maybe that's what I would look up. What could cause a false positive in a drug screen from a reliable source? And I'd have to look that up for you.
And another question we have is, can you describe how contingency management works?
Yeah, great questions, all these questions. Contingency management is more of behavioral modification and incentives. So, hey, if you come for your appointment, we'll give you a $5 gift card. If you have a negative drug screen, we'll give you a $10 gift card. If they escalate, okay, you did it once. Now, next time, if you have five negative drug screens, we'll give you a $20 gift card. And they say that it takes, $200, $500 total for the program to make the incentives worthwhile. And the incentives are, as the difficulty of the process goes, the amount that you're getting goes up. And if there's a relapse, there's a way to, you don't get the reward this time, let's try for a different goal and we'll try again, and move in that direction. And so you could see, there's money involved in creating incentives, either dollars or gift cards in producing a specific outcome that's measured, like coming to an appointment, negative drug screen, and that kind of thing.
Our next question is, I have a lot of clients that are prescribed Adderall tell me that they test positive for methamphetamine because of the Adderall. I've spoken with the lab and many of them are not helpful. Is that common?
Okay. Adderall is amphetamine without the methyl group. So if you take Adderall, you'll be positive for amphetamine. If you're also positive for methamphetamine, you didn't get it from the Adderall.
And our next question, is there a particular detox medication protocol for meth intoxication, i.e. symptomatic meds?
We have our own. I don't think that it's necessarily written down as a protocol and it's really symptom related. And like I said, the symptoms can be from agitated delirium, really a life-threatening violent condition, where that's not a protocol. That has to be in the emergency department, and emergency physicians throughout our country know how to do that with various ways, just getting control. To something maybe more useful in an outpatient setting of just psychosis. We commonly use Zyprexa to help with that psychosis associated with being high on methamphetamine and paranoid and agitated. And there's no antidote. There's an antidote for opioids, right? With naloxone, there's no antidote for methamphetamine, cocaine. You have to wait it out in your symptoms, wait it out till it's out of your system. And the symptoms that we treat it's not like nausea, vomiting, or constipation or other things like that. The main symptom is psychosis, and that we treat.
And the next question we have is, would you please describe tweaking?
I was trying to get out of that. But tweaking is a choreotic movement of, you know, the body, of the head, of the arms, and it really everywhere. And you can see the person is not sitting calmly holding their head still. They're moving it around and not aware that they're doing that.
We have another Tennessee question. In Tennessee, opioids are tightly regulated and we have state guidelines. However, there are no similar guidelines for our benzodiazepines or prescribed stimulants. Do you know of any states that have guidelines for prescribed stimulants or benzos?
I love that question because that goes to something that I really advocate for the medical community, which is really what you're talking about is safe prescribing. And I talked about safe prescribing when I was at the White House, because at that time, all focus was on opioids. And I'm thinking ahead, you know, knowing that the opioid prescription epidemic is on its way down, and thinking ahead that we need to talk about safe prescribing, not just opioids, to the medical community. And that means a combination of all central nervous system depressants, not even just benzos. We have to talk, all these things are additive. And I learned that from the study that really got me involved in this. I published what it's called the Death Diaries. And I looked at every single person in San Diego, all 257 of them that died of prescription. And that was at the peak of the opioid epidemic. And I realized this is not just an opioid problem, because while hydrocodone and oxycodone were number one, clonazepam was number three. And there was a huge problem of benzodiazepines and Benadryl and sleep aids. So if we really wanted and then I have a graph, which this was a different lecture, but I have a graph of looking at all deaths and looking at just the prescription related deaths. And if we want to go to baseline where we were in 1990, as far as deaths from medications, and have that as part of what the medical community needs to focus on. And again, this is a whole nother lecture, but then we need to talk about safe prescribing. So as far as protocols, there's some that NIDA publishes about really warning about combination of benzodiazepine and opioids and how 30% of those deaths are associated with that. But, you know, we really have a whole curriculum for the medical community to focus on safe prescribing. And safe prescribing means, you know, even if you're on the right dose of opioids and the right dose of benzodiazepine and the right dose of sleeping pills and taking over-the-counter Benadryl, all that combination can end up a statistic with the medical examiner's office. So that's really a whole program. And I would add marijuana to that too, because people take that as their medicine. So yeah, I don't know if I have we have a whole curriculum that actually, if you email me later, it'll be published on safe, we call it Innovations in Safe Prescribing. And once we have that officially out in the market, we would share that with you.
This may be our last question. While discussing fentanyl, you mentioned that patients come in who have used methamphetamine and should be experiencing a high at around hour three, but they are very sick in fetal position. How many cases or average percent do you think do not go in the hospital in this instance?
Most probably don't come to the hospital. Most people don't come to the hospital who have that. We know that from the number of people that we know that are using, and then other people who are dying, and then our patient population. So we just see a small percentage of what's out there.
Okay. And this will actually be our last question. And this goes back to the Adderall question that we asked before. So did I understand you correctly that someone takes Adderall could test positive for amphetamines only, but someone using methamphetamines would test positive for both meth and amphetamines?
You guys are chemists. You got it. Yeah. And if understanding that slide with the picture of what methamphetamine looks like and what amphetamine looks like, and understanding that things break down, you'll understand that you know meth goes to amphetamine, but amphetamine can't go into meth. Great questions.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody.
Next slide, please. That would be Bonnie Price from Bonsa Course. And I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Lev. What would you like to say here?
Oh, I just wanted Bonnie to say closes. Thank you. No, just thank you so much. Really honor. I know people have lots of questions. And that means things went well and happy to help out where I can.
So in conclusion, wanted to say to everyone, the PowerPoint for this presentation and a link to the recording will be made available to the attendees. So look for that. Dr. Lev, thank you so much for the wonderful information. I think that people found it very useful. I know that I did. Bonsecore Mercy Health was pleased to offer this webinar to you all, and we thank all of the attendees for coming. Should you have any questions for Dr. Lev, her contact information will be in the PowerPoint. Please email her. And we ask that everyone complete the evaluation. And we hope that you all have a good afternoon. That concludes our webinar for today.
One more slide. One more. There you go. Yes, thank you. Have a great afternoon.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.